Okay, well, welcome to the Ralph Winterroad Show. This is Ralph Kermit Winterroad II coming to you live out of Alaska. It's about 50 degrees in Alaska, overcast, and it is a good day. I got my van that they absconded with in March. I luckily got it out of the sale for $385 yesterday. For 1994, so I'm back to two vehicles again, got to get licensed, and that's another story. But our privilege today to have a guest from the UK on, Andrew Johnson. Are you there? Oh, I guess we're going to conference him in after the break here. So anyway, he's going to be here, and we're going to be talking about the 911 issue. He's works in conjunction with Dr. Judy Wood. So, anyway, well, as soon as we get him cornered here, you know, he's on the Skype here, so we're going to talk to that, and that's going to be the subject for today. And in the process also got more astounding information going to be publishing on the Administrative Procedures Act. It's just that guillotine is getting really sharp, and they're going to have to deal with this before it's over. There's just no getting around it. Ball game over, and we're going to get it. We're going to get these guys before it's over. So anyway, we'll probably be going to be hearing from the break here in just a minute, but as soon as we get it worked out, we're going to have Andrew Johnson on, and then we're going to address some of the other issues. As far as the thermite and some of the other, what should we say, conspiracy theory or cover stories. That's what we would probably want to call them. Some of the other cover stories that are running around out there, and he's going to address those. So I hear the music, and we'll be back, and we'll get us all hooked up here, and stay tuned. Well, we're back from break, and this is Ralph Kermit Winterroad II, Ralph Winterroad Show, coming to you live out of Alaska, and I am honored today to have Andrew Johnson out of the UK. Are you there, Andrew?
I'm here. Thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah, the bio here says you grew up in Yorkshire, England, and graduated from Lancaster University in 86, and you have a degree in computer science and physics. And you also are interested in what's known as alternative knowledge.
Yeah.
I got a couple of questions before we get into the real meat of this. Do we call people from the UK Brits, or what do we call you?
Brits is pretty common. Yeah, that's probably about the easiest one, I think, to go with. Yeah.
Englishman, that's another good one, huh?
Yeah, that's sort of slightly old-fashioned, and but Englishman probably, that's used more in jokes though, actually, because you say an Englishman, an Irishman, and a Scotsman, so you know.
How do you handle? Are the Brits still over 1776 and 1812, the Revolutionary War?
Yeah, I mean, we don't really talk about that much, really, here. People don't seem to think of, America as anything to do with Britain so much as the only thing is that we sort of two countries divided by a common language, really, you know. that's about the only way, I think, that it's viewed. We don't really think about the American independence as being significant to Britain that much now, I don't think, really.
Well, what do you call us in spite of Obama and our Nobel Peace Prize? What's the word that the Brits call America? Do they call us Americans, or they call us?
Yeah, just mainly Americans, really. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the most common term, yeah.
Well, I got one more question, and we'll get into the meat of it here. We have our 911s that we're going to talk about, and you have your crop circles.
There's been quite a lot of activity on crop circles over the last sort of 10 years, particularly. It's really changed quite a lot in that time, and I think there is actually a connection to 9/11 directly.
Really?
I spoke about this at a conference in just about a month ago, about 3-4 weeks ago. I mentioned it because I actually did a presentation about crop circles, because that's
really
something that I've that was the 13th of September. I did that And yeah, we could mention that maybe if we get time.
Yeah, okay, well, yeah, I'd be interested in that, because I thought it was just something you Brits over there got out of the pubs, and you're a little bit, you know, on a bit of a lark, and you go out there and screw with the public or something. You never know anymore, you know.
That's true.
Well, anyway, the main crux of this show today is you obviously know Dr. Judy Wood, and you've done a lot of research and been involved with the 911 cover stories and that, and I became aware of Dr. Judy Wood because when I first thought, I thought it was a hoax, and then I started looking and I said, my golly gee whiz, man, have I had the wool pulled over my eyes. And
absolutely.
So anyway, where, you know, the things that struck me, and you can just wherever you want to go with this, but there was no collapse. The things that really struck me, number one is, where did the building rubble go?
Yeah.
Number two is, how do all these cars that are around this area have all these strange things? They flip over, they you can call it get burnt or whatever the word, you'll enlighten us here with the technical terms. And then we have a hurricane level three sitting there. Nobody wants to talk about it. So just jump in where you would want to go. And then I'd like to address the people with the thermite and explosions and all that. Just however you want to bring it forward.
Sure. I think that, you know, I felt the same way as you do in terms of when I came across what Dr. Judy Wood has said. And she did point out some very basic things, and it's really quite humbling, because you realise that you've actually missed some very basic observations, such as, you say, you know, where did the buildings actually go? And you know, we all saw the towers came down, you know, and I was, you know, I freely admit, unlike Dr. Wood, I was taken in by the official story. You know, I was taken in for probably about 3 years, and I thought it was a bit strange, but I think I was so horrified by it, I didn't want to think about it, and I think that's one of the key things, that the way it was done has actually prevented people from actually thinking about it, because the event itself was extremely horrific, and also the way it was presented and how it was actually spun from the moment it happened, that really shut down most people's intellectual reasoning so that it just wasn't really operating when it came to 9/11, and I think once that was done, it took a lot of people. I mean, it took me 3 years to actually, you know, wake up and start thinking about it again. And then we've, you know, following that, really, I was taken in by the bombs in the building stories, and I thought, oh yeah, you know, they've got all these witness accounts of these bombs going off, and you know, we can see the squibs coming out of the building, and I'd watched the Loose Change film, you know, Loose Change 2, and it showed it going down. They said controlled demolition. I thought, oh yeah, it's got to be something like that, because, you know, it can't have been just a planes crashing into it. But then you go back to the question of where did the building actually go, and the point about that is that it did actually turn into dust, and that is again becomes something you cannot debunk. You cannot debunk the question of where did the building go, and particularly the hardest question of all, which needs to be answered, is where did the steel go? I mean, if we go with the bombs in the building idea, we can imagine that the concrete, you know, might have been sort of blasted into fairly small pieces by sufficiently powerful explosives. But I don't know of any explosives that can turn steel into dust. And, you know, that's the key thing. And one of my favorite pictures that Dr. Wood has collected is sequence of the spire, this thing called the spire, which is a 70 stories high column of steel, and you can actually see this disappearing over a period of about 5 or 10 seconds into dust, and you can see there is no flame, there is no bomb, you know, there's nothing. This thing is literally turning to dust before your eyes, and I've showed this to people, and they go, where did you get that? Well, I've never seen that before. And of course, if you hear the phrase, I've never seen that before, never heard that before, you know that the cover-up has been successful. So all the key evidence, the very basic evidence, has been successfully covered up for you know, over 5 years, probably 6-7 years even, and it's only with Dr. Judy Wood's sort of presentation of that evidence that we've been reawakened to what actually happened and allowed to explore the important initial question of what actually happened before you know you go on to the other questions. And so once I'd seen this steel turn into dust, I knew that we were looking at something which wasn't conventional. And you know, and Dr. Wood had already said, you know, directed energy weapons by the time I'd sort of come to get in contact with her. And I was thinking, yeah, well, it's got to be something like that, because I know of no other technology. So
let me interrupt you. What's the source of that video? Because I saw that, and that's absolutely just shocking to watch.
Yeah, well, there is a... Actually, I think Dr. Wood's got two sets of still images taken by different photographers. I think one's a sequence of four images and one's a sequence of five, I think, taken from different places. So there's the stills. And then there is also a CNN news clip. And I think it's one with Peter Jennings talking over it. And he's saying, oh, you know, the towers were destroyed. This is terrible. Or, you know, words like that. And you can actually see in the video this spire actually physically turning to dust before your very eyes. And then there are actually a couple of other videos where you can see it as well, but because it's a different angle, you know, you see one of these videos is taken against the background of the sky, so you can actually see it more clearly, and then one's taken from another angle where you've got a backdrop of one of the other towers, I think, so you can't quite see it turn into dust as clearly, but you can still see it. So, you know, we've got two sets of stills, probably two or three videos of this thing actually happening. And when you just pause on that and look at it, you have to really question what you've been told, not only by the official story, but also by this, as you mentioned there in the introduction, this thermite idea, which again I was taken in by, and I sort of got quite closely involved in part of that story, which was ultimately how I got in touch with Dr. Wood. And the reason why I got involved with that is because this Steve Jones character, who's this physicist from Brigham Young University, I was actually invited by him and Jim Fetzer to join this group that they were starting up. It was called Scholars for 9/11 Truth. And that happened at the end, just right at the very end of 2005, I think it was about December the 14th or something like that, so it's quite close. And I got an email from Steve Jones saying, oh, let's invite Andrew onto the scholars group. And I was thinking, oh, this sounds interesting, that some academics are actually getting together and, you know, hopefully we can get some real, you know, proper brains onto this to try and actually, you know, do something with it and work out what actually happened. And but I was a little bit surprised to get an invitation, because I'm not, you know, a full-time academic by any stretch of the imagination. I do work part-time for the Open University here in England. But it's actually, we deal with correspondence courses. You know, the Open University has been going since about 1969, I think we just had our 40th anniversary this year. And I've been sort of working part-time with them for about, I think, 6 years now, 7 years even now. But my sort of academic work with them is very low level, in terms of I just tutor on one module of this computer course, and I don't do any sort of advanced research for the university. So I was a little bit surprised to get invited into this scholars group, which has been made up of professors and doctors and you know, and people with master's degrees and authors and all this kind of thing. So,
hold on just a second, sure. Here. We're going to break. I hear the music, and we're going to stay tuned, folks. We're going to get some straight information here. Back in a minute. We're back from break here, and I have Andrew Johnson out of the UK, and we're talking about 911, and he was talking about the thermite and being asked to join. And go ahead, Andrew.
Sure, yeah. So I was asked to join this scholars group. And that was at the end of 2005, and we sort of Steve Jones had written this paper about how the tower was destroyed using thermite, and one of the key bits of evidence that he was citing was this video, and there was this video of this supposedly this liquid metal coming out of one of the sides of one of the towers, you know, quite a way up, I think about 70 or 80 stories up or something like that. And he got this video, and it was came from the Camera Planet archive. And he wanted me to splice this together. Or in fact, he didn't want me to. He said, can anybody do this? And I offered to do it because I'd sort of captured this video clip from Google Video, and I knew how to sort of convert the format, you know, to another format and stuff like that, because I fiddle around with things like that quite a lot myself on my own computer. And then he wanted to put it side by side with this thermite demonstration, which was from like one of these junkyard challenge programs. As a UK program called Brainiac, where they were trying out thermite to see how destructive it was, and they melt through a car's engine block with it, with this demonstration. And so what I ended up doing was making a video clip of that, and we put them side by side so that he could put these in a PowerPoint presentation. And I thought, yeah, you know, this did look very similar, so maybe because of this video clip, maybe it was thermite that was in the towers. And I was thinking, you know, well, this guy's obviously a PhD physicist. He knows what he's doing. And so I went along with that, really, and I printed out some copies of his paper that he'd written, which was about, I think, about 30 pages long, something like that, where he went through this and some other aspects of evidence. I was giving these copies of things out to people. But it was, I think it was about, probably, yeah, it's probably about 6-7 months later, getting towards late 2006, and I then found that there was an article by Dr. Morgan Reynolds and Dr. Wood, and they actually mentioned my name in it. And I'm thinking, oh, well, why am I in this article? Because, you know, I was just doing my own thing in the UK, you know, sending a few emails, and I didn't really see that anyone should have noticed what I was doing. But they'd referred to this video clip that I'd made of the thermite, and they'd mentioned this in the article, and I think it's still on, this article is still on Morgan Reynolds' site. You can go and look at it. And and then I looked at what they'd written, and I realized that there was something strange going on, and that these two people had actually been marginalized, and their own research of how the towers were destroyed, which was looking at a different, you know, conclusion, basically, they'd been put on one side. So I'm thinking, oh, this looks a bit strange. I'll have to look into this a bit more. And eventually that's when I came across, you know, the what Dr. Wood had presented, that the steel had turned to dust. And I'm thinking, hang on a minute, that can't happen with thermite. Thermite can't do that. But it still took me probably another 6 months for that information to kind of percolate through and start to make more and more sense to me. And it was in early 2007 that I wrote an article which I called The New 9/11 Hijackers, because by that time there'd been this sort of fallout between Steve Jones and Jim Fetzer. Well, Jim Fetzer was the co-founder of Scholars, and they had these big arguments about who earned the domain name for the website and who'd founded it and who hadn't, and who was going to side with whom. And Jim Fetzer was saying that Dr. Wood's research was very meritorious and it should be followed up. And Steve Jones was saying, no, it doesn't explain the evidence. Only thermite explains it, and all of this stuff, you know. And I think it was around that time that I discovered something extremely interesting. And this was that Steve Jones had been involved in cold fusion research in the late 1980s. And in fact, what he'd done is he published a paper on his own research, which was into something called muon-catalyzed cold fusion. Now, this was a way of actually creating a low-level nuclear fusion reaction, more or less at room temperature. And this is a very unconventional way of creating fusion reactions, because normally they're done at very, very high temperatures, using very complicated and very advanced equipment. Steve Jones published this paper the day before these two chemists had their press conference at the, I think it was at the University of Utah. And curiously, Steve Jones was in Brigham Young, which is at Provo, also in Utah. So he's at one of the other Utah universities. And so Pons and Fleischmann published their paper on cold fusion, and Steve Jones had effectively tried to steal their thunder the day before. And I was already quite aware of what happened with Cold Fusion. In fact, when I first got my internet connection in the late 90s, in about 1996, 97, Cold Fusion was one of the first things I started to do research on. I was very interested in what's called free energy technology, of which Cold Fusion is one version. In other words, the big thing with Cold Fusion that Pons and Fleischmann were claiming, which was why they were attacked, is that they were getting more energy out of their experiments in many, many cases than they were actually putting in. So in other words, they might put 100 watts of electricity into the experiment, and then they'd use what's called a calorimeter, which measures the heat output, and they get 150 watts out. And of course, all the scientists said, well, that's impossible. You know, there's absolutely no way that you can get energy out of a tabletop experiment, you know, that's greater than the amount than what you put in.
Mm-hmm. Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a minute. We got a break, and then we got a full 20 minutes. We'll be back. Stay tuned. Well, we're back from break here, and I got Andrew out of the UK, and we're talking about 911 today. Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, so basically, you know, I was talking about the connection of the Steve Jones character to Cold Fusion. And, you know, somebody had basically posted this video clip, which was actually from a documentary made in the year 2000. And I think, you know, you can still track this down on the internet. And the documentary is called Heavy Watergate. And it's all about the Cold Fusion cover-up. In other words, Cold Fusion is real, and you can... if you do it right, get out more energy than you put in. Whether it can be sustained and produced as used as a viable large-scale energy production source is obviously open to question. But the research was essentially marginalised and shut down. And this was really shown quite clearly by Dr. Eugene Mallop, who is now sadly no longer with us. Because what he did in 1991... is he essentially resigned from his job. Dr. Eugene Mallov worked at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he was the lead science writer. And what he did was he had to write up the story of Cold Fusion for, you know, the various publications that Massachusetts Institute of Technology produced. And he started to study the data which was coming out. And then what happened was they were asked to reproduce Pons and Fleischmann's experiment and see if they could find this excess heat, in other words, getting more energy out than they were putting in. And they did. Massachusetts Institute of Technology reproduced the experiment, and Mallov actually looked at their own report, and he studied it carefully, and he found that they'd actually fudged their data to hide the excess heat. He could see what they'd done. So they essentially tried to debunk the Cold Fusion effect, and he realized this, and he went to his superior. I've got an audio of him describing this, actually. It's on my website. And he describes where he went to his superior to sort of say, well, look, you know, I know that they're hiding the data here. And then his superior said, well, I know I've worked in physics for 50 years, and I know what's possible and I know what isn't possible. And what is shown in this experiment is not possible. And Mallard basically said he realized at that point it was time for him to leave. And so he did. And he formed this, I think he called it the New Energy Initiative or New Energy Foundation or Infinite Energy Foundation. I get the names mixed up. And he started to try and sort of raise money for funding into further Cold Fusion experiments and other things like Cold Fusion, because he found there's a whole raft of discoveries which have been covered up, you know, Tesla, and then there's Wilhelm Reich's work on orgone energy, which he can produce orgone accumulators, for example. And Mallov did a lot of research into all of that. And anyway, so he wrote this book called Fire from Ice, and it was published in 1991, and it was actually nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. It's a bit hard to get hold of this book now, but you can still get hold of copies. It's out of print, but I think you can still get copies. And I have read it. I've got this book and I've read it.
What's the name of it again?
It's called Fire from Ice, and it's by Dr. Eugene Mallov.
Okay. Go ahead.
And if you look at the index in that book, you'll see that Steve Jones is mentioned on 100 pages of that book. So he has a very significant part to play in the Cold Fusion story. So we had Steve Jones working for Los Alamos National Laboratories, which he doesn't make any secret about that. We've got him getting involved in cold fusion, and his job seemed to be in cold fusion. Not to say that cold fusion wasn't real and it was a load of rubbish. His job was to say that you couldn't get excess heat from any cold fusion type of reactions. It just was not possible. And we've actually got an audio clip of him essentially stating that and trying to stamp out anyone who suggested otherwise. So it's what we call a limited hangout. In other words, he wasn't denying that something like cold fusion was real, but it was, it might as well not be real because it was of no use to anyone. That's essentially what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
Which really sort of tied in when you look at the energy question in relation to 9/11. It's very similar because he was saying it was just 9/11 was done by somebody other than Al Qaeda, or it was done by something other than the plan by Osama bin Laden, which of course bin Laden said he wasn't involved with it in the early days, but then that was all changed, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So he was doing another limited hangout. And that's when I started to get really suspicious. And so then, going back to the Scholars Group issue, what happened was Steve Jones and Jim Fetzer split up. And Steve Jones formed the Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. And Jim Fetzer went and carried on with the Scholars for 9/11 Truth. And I sort of stayed on that side. And there were a few people on that side. And most of them seemed to be supporting Dr. Judy Wood. And that seemed to be quite reasonable at the time. The next real change came, again, it was ended up being to do with energy, because we'd been talking, Dr. Wood had been talking about energy weapons. And this eventually leads you to the question of where did the energy come from? And Steve Jones and Greg Jenkins, they basically said, well, it can't have been an energy weapon because the amount of energy that you would need to destroy the towers is just humongous. And I think somebody calculated it as something like 75 terawatts, something like that. It's five times the Earth's annual output of energy, which is, I think it works out 75 terawatts, which is, so many million, billion, trillion watts or something. And but what they were claiming was that this would be the energy that's required to vaporize the towers. And what does vaporize mean? It means, well, turn it from a solid to a liquid and then to a gas. But that's not what Dr. Wood was saying. She didn't say it turned from a solid to a liquid to a gas, which is what a vapor is, just another word for a gas. She said that it turned to dust. So these calculations that they were claiming, could be used to prove that Dr. Wood was wrong, just on the basis of it, weren't applicable, because she was not even saying that the towers were vaporized. And this, you'll still hear people saying this, that they were vaporized. And they'll typically say it was a nuclear explosion or something. I mean, there's people who talk about this. So I knew that they were trying very, very hard to basically debunk what Dr. Wood had put on the table, so it was obviously very important. I think I should go back a little step here, because I've missed out a very important connection too. Whilst Dr. Wood was putting together this research into the directed energy, she had heard that Steve Jones was claiming that if you heat up aluminium, it will stay silvery in colour at all temperatures in daylight conditions. In other words, if you keep heating aluminium, it will still be silvery in appearance however much you heat it when you see it in daylight conditions. This is not true. It's completely false. If you heat up aluminium enough, beyond its melting point, which is, I think, is about 600 degrees centigrade, something like that, when you get to a high enough temperature, about 1400, it will still go orange as other metals do when they're heated up sufficiently. And Steve Jones was talking about this because he claimed that this film, which I've been involved in editing the video clip for, couldn't be molten aluminium because it was orange. It had to be molten iron, which was the byproduct of a thermite reaction. So that was his evidence for saying it was thermite. So, and when Judy Wood had posted this demonstration on her website, she'd done it with the assistance of Michael Zabur, who was one of her students. And I'm not sure if this came up in your discussion with Dr. Wood, a few weeks ago.
No, it didn't.
No. And Michael Zabur was actually murdered in, I think it was April 2006, I think it was, around that time. So he was murdered, and he was murdered in a mugging. And it was very strange how this happened. If you go and you can, it was reported on the local news and stuff, and you can go and find that if you need to. But Michael Zabur actually had an uncle, and his uncle was involved in free energy technology research. And in fact, he helped Dr. Eugene Malov on this New Energy Foundation research. He was involved in writing one of the journals that they were producing. So we have a connection between energy and Steve Jones and energy and Dr. Judy Wood's student, Michael Zabur, through Michael Zabur's uncle. So this was all, you know, too much of a coincidence to ignore.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were then seeing, you know, the connections into the energy issue all over, stamped all over this. And in fact, you then have to ask, you know, again, where did the energy come from? And quite wisely, Dr. Wood didn't attempt to answer that question initially. What she did was what any scientist should do, and you keep looking at the evidence. If you go to a crime scene and you can't solve it initially, you have to keep looking for more and more evidence until you can build up a full picture, as full a possible picture of what actually happened, so that you can rule out all the other things which are not going to explain the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what she continued to do. And it was then sort of late 2007 when she had revisited what was called the Hutchison effect, because she'd seen this on various websites prior to sort of late 2007. You know, she'd got some reference on a website and some appendix, you know, at the bottom of a page, hadn't really looked at it. But then we were prompted to revisit it, or she was, and then she sort of Skyped me or something, and she sort of drew my attention to these phenomena. And it was in late 2007 that she pointed out the upside-down cars, the flipped cars at the World Trade Center. And then when I saw that, I already knew about the Hutchison effect. In fact, I heard about the Hutchison effect in 1998, because I'd read a book which talked about it. So I was already familiar with it, and I'd watched a video in 1999 by Nick Cook, and John Hutchison was featured in that, or rather his experiments were. So I'd already heard of it from that, you know, years prior to this. And I knew that he was able to create this levitation effect. And I knew that he was able to create this deformed metal, these jellified metal samples. And so what Dr. Wood had got is she'd got all these bits of evidence, and she'd got the Hutchison effect and the World Trade Center evidence. And we had about six or seven different phenomena which were totally lined up with the Hutchison effect. And so she'd sort of collected all these pictures, and I sort of said, well, you know, would you like me to write sort of an introduction and just sort of summarize this? And she said, yeah, well, you know, why don't you, sort of thing. And so I just put a summary to page together, which was collected about sort of 12 or 16 of these images, something like that. And so we had, you know, we had the bent beams, we had the upside down cars, we had the deformed beams, which were turned to jelly. And we could see these effects in John Hutchison's experiments. He'd actually got physical, touchable metal samples. He got 500 pounds of metal samples. He'd also seen weird fires as well, and these spontaneous fires coming out of almost of thin air. And we actually got a video of this, little boat experiment he did. And people said, oh, this was just a fake, it was a hoax, and blah, blah, blah. But what struck me as odd is, if this guy was faking this stuff, how come he had a set of evidence which precisely matched what was seen at the World Trade Center? We have, you know, witness accounts of people being levitated. One of my favorite ones is David Hansher's account. David Hansher was a photographer for the New York Daily News, and we've got this video of him being interviewed by Charlie Rose on a PBS program, I think it was, in October 2001, where David Hansher describes being lifted up into the air and carried a block by this sort of cloud of material, and then laid down. You know, that's on video, not the actual video of him, you know, flying through the air, but his account is on video, so you can go and check that out on YouTube. And at the same time, the other thing which he brought in was David Hanscher was actually at the World Trade Center when the supposed second plane struck, and he took this picture. And again, they showed this picture on this interview, and you can see the fireball coming out of the tower, but there's no plane on it. There's no evidence of any plane. There's no plane debris falling down. It's just this jet of flame coming out of the tower. And he said he heard a buzzing sound, but he never saw the plane. And that's on the account too. Yeah. So, yeah, some very strange stuff coming out. You know, and but the thing that I was going to mention in terms of the Hutchison effect is when we presented this to Jim Fetzer and a couple of others that were in a little email group that we were working with, one of whom was this character called Ace Baker. They suddenly started to say, "Oh, John Hutchison, we know that he's a fraud." You know, and this is not very good for 9/11 truth, because the Hutchison effect is a fraud. We know it's just video fakery, and this can't be right. You know, and this is totally wrong, and all this. And we then started to get attacked quite severely for this. And Jim Fetzer eventually ended up making a threat to Judy Wood. That's what it read like. Anyway, he said if Dr. Wood wants to salvage her reputation, she should back off her relations with John Hutchison. And I'm thinking, well, who is this guy? I mean, this scholars group that I was in, it's just an informal group. It's not funded. You know, it's not. You don't have to sign a membership form or anything like that. There are no rules. There's no agreement. There's nothing. So how can this Fetzer character threaten Dr. Judy Wood's reputation over a bit of 9/11 research? It just does not make any sense, except if you look at it from the point of view that it's actually exactly over the target, and it's extremely important that the connection between 9/11 and the Hutchison effect is not made in the public consciousness. And so we sort of carried that forward. We were pretty, you know, the evidence really speaks for itself, and people that I've shown this to cold have gone. A lot of people, some people you just can't take it in, you know, because it's just too much, but quite a lot of people who are actually open to it will look at it and say, "Oh my God, you know, this is really, I've never seen this before. This is just so obvious." I was showing it to somebody last week, a conference I was at, last weekend, and they were saying this. I explained to them in about 10 minutes, and they were just saying, "Well, I've never seen this, but it's just so obvious. You know, now you tell me about the towers turning to dust and stuff like that." You know, and then if we look at what the Hutchison effect does in terms of the energy issue, he appears to get out more energy than he puts in. In other words, he can melt metal with 1500 watts of power. You know, 1500 watts of power is what you use to boil a kettle, and yet he was able to bend in half an aluminium beam, which was about 2 inches square. You know, and how would you do that with 1500 watts of power? Well, what you'd seem to be able to do is perhaps in the way that cold fusion is doing, is you're unlocking some kind of lower level energy source, which is you know, feeding energy into the material from some kind of subatomic or quantum level or something like that. And if you go and research into this more, you learn about things like what's called the Casimir effect, which is kind of a nuclear level. It's a type of force which keeps materials bound together.
Hold that thought right there. This is absolutely amazing how this has happened in America. Okay, back in a minute. Well, we're back for break here, and boy, I got astounding information on free energy background with 911. We have Andrew from the UK. Go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, when you start to look at this, the knowledge about the sort of free energy, and you look into this idea that there seems to be some way of actually getting energy out of the vacuum or from within a material, and this is what John Hutchison seems to have been demonstrating in sort of two or three different ways for the last sort of 25 years, really. And once you start fiddling around with this stuff, it seems to open up things like anti-gravity technology, free energy technology, propulsion systems, replacing all our existing sort of fossil fuel-based sources. So you really are looking at hacking away at the control mechanisms of our sort of westernized, organized civilizations, really, because you're putting things onto a new level. And the energy question is really the key to everything that's going on in the world right now. You know, you just pick any issue and it will be affected by the reality of free energy and how it will transfer. You know, just imagine, for example, a drought in any country. If you have free energy, you can desalinate as much of the oceans as you need to provide, and you can pump the water, you know, across the planet, or you can use an anti-gravity craft to carry it there. You know, once you've got free energy, those things are just not problems anymore. And again, you know, I've looked at digressing for a short minute. I've looked at a lot of different areas about things like anti-gravity technology and the UFO issue and that sort of thing. And the energy question ties into all of them. And I think one of the reasons why a lot of these things are covered up and muddled up is to keep this idea that free energy is just a dream. You know, it's not real, it's a fantasy. But John Hutchison has made it very real, and he's been demonstrating free energy effects for 25 years. And for anyone who wants to investigate John Hutchison specifically, they can go to a website which is called thehutchisoneffect.com. That's HUTCHISON effect.com, and they will find, you know, videos, documents that John has put together from people that have sent him stuff. John's done work for the Department of Defense in the past, but he's a very, very unusual character, John. I think he just likes to have fun. You know, I think he's signed these various contracts, and then I don't think he's ended up delivering what they wanted him to deliver. And so he's just kind of gone off and done something else. So, you know, it's very interesting to find out about John and the way that he's kind of dealt with things. But we, you know, we got in touch with John late 2007, early 2008. And I was when we were discussing this, I think I said something like to Judy, like, well, I don't think he's really going to talk to us, because anybody that tries to make this connection between energy and 9/11 is going to want to run a mile, because it's so dangerous. But much to our surprise, not only did John talk to us, and he sort of verified some of the stuff, you know, some of his perspective on stuff, John actually ended up submitting an affidavit in Dr. Wood's legal case, which I don't think you got to, because Dr. Wood, once she realized that the towers had turned to dust, She essentially decided that it was time to correct NIST's report. NIST is the National Institute for Standards and Technology, and it's a non-regulatory government body, and they produced about 10,000 pages of reports about the destruction of the World Trade Center. And they talked about the collapse of the World Trade Center, and Dr. Wood knew that it didn't collapse, so she had to correct them on that.
Okay, well, stay tuned. We're going to get to an update on the litigation that Dr. Wood did, and then we're going to get into more of information on 911, the real truth with the evidence. What a novel idea. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a minute with Andrew out of the UK. Well, we're back from break here, and I got Andrew Johnson out of the UK, and absolutely amazing information. He's been laying the groundwork on the thermite and energy, how that relates into this here, this cold fusion. And why don't you go ahead, Andrew, and continue on here.
Sure, yeah. So, you know, one thing that was very interesting is you find out a lot of connections between the people that are involved in this picture. I mean, if we mentioned John Hutchison already, now I knew from previous things that I'd read that John Hutchison had been visited by a team from Los Alamos National Laboratories, which we've already mentioned once, and he was visited by them in 1983. And there's a character called Colonel John Alexander who went to stay with John and work with John Hutchison for 4 months. And John Alexander makes no secret of this. And from what has been described, it looks as if John Alexander knew what John Hutchison was doing, in terms of he knew the sort of effects and how they were created. He seemed to understand what was going on before he even went there. And John Alexander doesn't say that John Hutchinson's a fraud. He doesn't say that at all. So this is somebody from Los Alamos National Laboratories. And then you find out that John Alexander is also connected with SRI, Stanford Research Institute, which has been involved with things like the remote viewing program, Operation Stargate. And you learn about all these sorts of connections. And then a figure which I'll perhaps mention later is also connected to SRI is Alfred Weber, who claims to be an international lawyer. But if we go back to where I was in terms of John Hutchinson, now, if people say that John is a fraud, then why did he submit an affidavit to the court of the Southern District of New York for Dr. Judy Wood's legal case? He actually decided to submit this affidavit, and I helped him write it out because John's are not big on the old writing front. You know, he does write, but he tends to write in sort of capital letters and things like this. So we basically needed to get all the information down, and I wrote out this affidavit, and you can see this on Dr. Wood's website, because to go back to where I was in terms of the NIST reports, Dr. Wood had found some basic flaws, like the towers didn't collapse, so even the title of the report was wrong. And she wanted to correct NIST on this, and there is a law called the Data Quality Act, DQA, and you can actually write to a government body and say the data in your reports that taxpayers have paid for is faulty and you need to correct it. And she wrote to them and told them this, and she produced this sort of 50, 60 page long document correcting some of the errors. I hear we've got another break.
Yeah, we got a short one here, but because of music, we'll be back in just a minute. Stay tuned. We'll be back here. This is astounding information. Well, we're back from break here and talking about 911 and free energy and cold fusion, and got Andrew out of the UK. And before you continue, do you have any contact information or any other information where people could get so they can learn more about what's going on?
Absolutely, yes. I have my own website. It's called checktheevidence.com. That's all one word. And if you go onto there, if people want to contact me, that's absolutely great. There's a contact button. They can click on that and, you know, type a message in there, and that will get sent through to me. There is also on that website, if you go onto the home page, there's a banner, and you can click on that, and that will take you to a free ebook, which covers, you know, a lot of the background to what I've been saying tonight, and other information as well. And I've put in there my sort of general conclusions and the things that I've tried to do to sort of get this information out there to the right people. Because, you know, what we're talking about here is not theory. It's well-established fact. And, you know, there are only really certain logical deductions that I think can be made from this. And I think those conclusions are vindicated by the actions which other people have taken to try and shut this discussion down. And so, you know, checktheevidence.com. If you go onto there, you've also got Dr. Judy Wood's website as well, of course, which is drjudywood.com. A lot of stuff you can download from there. You know, we've got MP3 files. I've got an audio section. If you click onto that and then click on the 911 section, you'll find all kinds of audios in there. You know, Steve Jones, Jim Fetzer, all these guys. You can download all that stuff. I've got articles on my website as well, which go through the background to the scholars group that I mentioned. All that, it's all, you know, I've tried to document it all so that people who are interested can, you know, read as much as they feel like reading to basically prove that what I'm telling you is true. And I'd just like to sort of mention this legal action that Dr. Wood took, because I think this really forced it sorted out the truthers from the non-truthers, really, I think, in a very basic way, which is this, that Dr. Wood had submitted what's called this request for correction. In other words, she'd you know, written to NIST and say, your report is incorrect because you described the towers as collapsing. And they did not collapse. They were destroyed using some type of directed energy weapon. And she compiled all this evidence into a 50-page document, pictures, descriptions, some calculations in terms of the freefall speed. Again, this is all on Dr. Wood's website. Sent them to NIST. And they wrote back and said, no, we're not going to correct our report because, as far as we're concerned, it is accurate. But we did not investigate the collapse. We only investigated the events up to the point of collapse. So even though their report is entitled The Collapse of the World Trade Center, Dr. Wood has a letter from NIST saying they did not investigate the collapse at all. So that is, to me, is fraud on its face. That is a fraudulent report. Now,
absolutely. Beyond fraud.
Yeah. Beyond fraud, and it, you know, that's $13 million worth of, I think it was either $13 or $16 million it cost to produce those reports. And again, if you go and look at who helped NIST produce those reports, because they used, they subcontracted the work, and they contracted the work to about 17 or 18 different companies, large and small. Three of those companies were Boeing, SAIC, and ARA. Boeing is obviously the aircraft manufacturer who do work for the military too. And SAIC is Science Applications International Corporation, a very strange company, and Applied Research Associates. And if you look at their websites, you can go look at their websites. You don't need to take my word for it. They all, without exception, all three of those do research into directed energy weapons, or they even manufacture directed energy weapon systems. Boeing is a co-contractor in the Airborne Laser Project, which was described as America's first directed energy weapon, and Applied Research Associates have this contract with the government to do directed energy weapons research and know all about directed energy weapons. So again, we have the energy connection laid bare for all to see. Anybody who wants to go and look at the evidence can see it laid out on their websites and everything. You don't have to take my word for it.
So all we got to do is open our minds and look at the facts and engage a little logic, and hopefully have an IQ on the plus side of 100.
Exactly. You know, it takes a long time to piece it together. You know, I mean, this has taken me. I had help from Dr. Wood, but it probably took me a couple of years to work all this out. So, you know, I've sort of taken it upon myself to try and summarize this, because I know people are always short of time, and you know, and sort of just distill it down to what people can grasp quickly and straightforwardly. So that's really been my, you know, goal in getting involved with this research. And going back to the affidavit and the court case and stuff, this brings out the idea of the thermite again, because if you go onto Dr. Wood's website, you'll see what's called her RFC, which I mentioned before, the request for correction. You'll see the document submitted for the legal case too. Now, the Steve Jones Group and the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth Group, they also submitted a request for correction to NIST, and they submitted it 3 weeks after Dr. Wood did. But in their request for correction, they did not mention thermite, and they did not mention molten metal. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can go onto their website. You can download their request for correction document and their appeal. And in the original document, thermite is not mentioned. But Steve Jones claims that the evidence for thermite is conclusive, and he claims to have this chain of custody for this dust sample. And they've written a scientific paper on it, and they published a scientific paper on the Bentham Open Science Journal, or Open Chemical Journal, I can't remember which. So they're claiming that this thermite is proved. Well, if it's proved, then why didn't they put it in their legal submission? You know, if it's not good enough to put in a legal submission, then why wasn't it in there?
Absolutely.
And they don't seem to have an answer for this. So that, again, you know, we've got we've got connection to Los Alamos, we've got the energy connection, the cold fusion cover-up. We've got this thermite, which appears to be basically another, you know, Al-Qaeda story. It's Al-Qaeda, son of Al-Qaeda did it story. And then Jones changes his story. He initially said the thermite was carried in loads. Then it changed to be nanothermite, which could either be an incendiary, which is something that burns, or an explosive. And then in March 2008, he said it could have been paint on thermite. And I've got an audio of him saying this, suggesting that it was paint on thermite. And how on earth are you going to ignite such a thing, you know, in a clandestine way? And I mean, it doesn't explain the evidence anyway. It doesn't explain the toasted cars. How can it invert cars? How can it bend steel girders into a horseshoe shape? How can it cause instant rusting, which is another phenomenon we saw? How can it affect the Bankers Trust building and melt girders in that, which Phil Misfema said there was no fire in the Bankers Trust building, but we've got a picture of a melted girder in there from a FEMA report. Which we think was the energy effect was essentially bled over into the Bankers Trust building. John Hutchison has sort of confirmed that you can get ongoing effects after the energy has been switched off. You know, you can see these samples of metal structurally changing at an atomic level if you've got the right equipment to test that. On and on and on this goes. So you know, I just think it's very important that people understand the energy connection to all of this, and that free energy is real. And not only is it real, it's been turned into a weapon. And I've, I, you know, again, in researching the free energy question, we've heard groups saying, well, just think if we did have free energy, when what if terrorists got hold of it? You know, because if terrorists get hold of this sort of technology, then they could destroy the world. Well, I'm sorry, but the terrorists have already got it. And not only have they already got it, they used it on 9/11. And that is what the evidence tells us, you know. It's very shocking, it's very frightening, but it is true. As far as I can tell, that is the only conclusion which I can draw from having studied, you know, the evidence for the last sort of 6 years, basically. That's my final conclusion. And I think
actual fact is whoever did it once, they can do it again.
Absolutely, and
more of it, maybe. Yeah, or say, hey, do this or do that, or social engineering, or hold it as a threat, or God knows what.
Well, this is it, and I think, you know, we another story I can tell you involves something that Dr. Wood got and I got involved in July 2007, because at that time there was a new law was passed by Bush, and it was to do with the continuity of government. In other words, what the government would do if there was a catastrophic terrorist attack and they had to, you know, move out of the sort of Capitol building and all that area and the White House. And they were going to transfer the continuity of government's responsibility for that to another agency, and this was in July 2007. And at the same time, we had Michael Chertoff, who was then the head of Homeland Security, saying that you know, they'd been receiving reports that Al-Qaeda had got hold of nuclear weapons, you know, from the Ukraine or something that had been smuggled out. And also at the same time, we had Steve Jones and Bill Deagle doing a discussion in a 9/11 Truth Conference in Vancouver, talking about 22 American cities being pre-wired with nukes. That's what Bill Deagle claims to have knowledge of. He says in this interview from 2007, I'm sure he still says the same thing, that 22 American cities have been pre-wired with nuclear explosives. Now, this is a very strange thing for him to be saying, because if I went out on the street and said something like that, I think Homeland Security would be wanting to talk to me, you know, and they'd probably have me up for a couple of days and interrogate me in a cell, you know, but that doesn't seem to have happened to him, oddly enough. So what we thought was, where they were planning was, if you go and look at Dr. Wood's website and you look at the pictures, it looks like a nuclear bomb went off at the World Trade Center, and we've heard other people saying that this is actually what happened. So we thought, well, let's see what we got, what's going on here. We've got Michael Chertoff saying Al-Qaeda nukes. We've got Bill Deagle and Steve Jones saying that the possibility of a nuke attack. What if they're planning to do another attack using the weapon, and then they're going to blame it on Al-Qaeda nuke, which we'll know wasn't real, when we know they're using that as a cover story for another use of the weapon? And we got to know a friend called Ambrose Lane, who does a talk show called We Ourselves, and that's in the Washington, D.C. area. But he was also at that time doing RBN. Sorry, not RBN. He was doing a Power XM channel program. And I'll tell you what happened to him after the break.
Okay, great. We'll be back in just a minute. UK, go ahead.
Sure, thanks. So what was happening is we'd looked at this idea of them using the weapon again. This was in July 2007, and blaming it on an Al-Qaeda nuke. And what we decided to do is we'd approached Ambrose Lane just to sort of talk about this idea on air, you know, just to sort of, we weren't trying to scare people, because we didn't have any evidence that this was, you know, actually what was going to happen. It was just a kind of postulation, really, that this was a possible way that they might try and disguise it. But basically, I was sat here waiting for the call because they were going to call me to go on this Power XM station. And Ambrose Lane at that time was one of the most popular hosts on that network, and he did 16 hours a week. And, you know, Dr. Wood was waiting in South Carolina, and the call never came. So I think a few hours later, or it might have been the next day, I rang the producer because I had his number. And I said, what happened with the call yesterday? And he said, oh, well, they cancelled the show. And I said, well, you know, did Ambrose go off sick or something? And he said, no, they cancelled the whole show. And they fired him. And Ambrose Lane was fired from the network on the day that we were due to go on. And he was actually driving into his parking space, I learnt next day. And he was fired from the network, and he never went back.
And, oh my God!
And then we had a similar situation about 18 months later with Richard Syrett, who's one of the hosts from who used to go on CFRB, and he, not long after he'd had Dr. Wood on, and he was talking about some other stuff on other programs, you know, with energy technology and this sort of thing with another physicist. It was about, I think, 2-3 months after that that he was fired from his network as well. So, you know, is somebody trying to sort of cover things up here and make sure the cat doesn't start running around too much now it's out of the bag? You know, I mean, that's the sense that we were getting, very, very real sense of that happening. And what we'd been witnessing on the internet, you know, if you posted something on a forum about this, any of the topics that I've sort of covered, within a few minutes, you'd get some anonymous poster coming on saying, oh, that Judy Wood, she's just a nutcase, you know, and all this sort of thing. And but again, you know, things started to move on because what happened next really was this Alfred Weber character. He entered the picture as well, because Alfred Weber, he's been involved in what's called the exopolitics movement. And he was at a conference which Dr. Wood gave a two-hour presentation at in August 2007, and this conference was organized by Jim Fetzer. And at that conference, Alfred Weber praised Dr. Wood's research very highly and unequivocally for proving that a directed energy weapon was used at the World Trade Center. And so we were quite gratified about that somebody was actually, you know, praising this research because it had been attacked so much prior to that. And that was all well and good. But then what happened was Dr. Wood and John Hutchison had started to, you know, sort of do this research together, or really I should say that John Hutchison was commenting on some of the material that Dr. Wood was compiling. And And then Dr. Wood visited John Hutchison in Vancouver, which was where this Alfred Weber chap lived. And he asked them to do an interview with him for his radio program, because he also runs a radio program. And they actually went to his house and they did this interview, and it was about an hour and 10 minutes long. And they talked about, you know, in more detail what I've talked about the effects of the World Trade Center and John Hutchison's experiments, et cetera, et cetera. And he broadcast this interview, but it was recorded on the 14th of February, and it wasn't broadcast until April, after somebody had talked about thermite on the same slot, same radio slot, and Alfred Weber had broadcast an interview with Richard Gage, mm-hmm. which was rather unusual. But we thought, hey, well, you know, he's just scheduled it that way, and it's we think it's slightly odd, but you know, that's we think it's slightly odd, so what? But then the following November, Alfred Weber came on to Sophia Shafquat. She did a radio program about 9/11 stuff, and Sophia Shafquat, people might not know her, but if people have seen a film called 9/11 Mysteries, she made this film called 9/11 Mysteries, and she said that it cost her $35,000, I think it was. She spent of her own money making this film. And we'd sort of emailed her a couple of times. And the 9/11 Mysteries film, it's actually a pretty well-made documentary if you watch it, for one that's not been on television, or at least it's not been on regular TV. It's pretty well-made, you know, it's well-produced. It's got a good sort of editing, good soundtrack, good voiceover. And we wondered if she'd be interested in making a documentary about some of the things that I've been talking to you about, the directed energy weapons research and the Hutchinson effect stuff. So we emailed her a couple of times, but she didn't really express much of an interest.
Mm-hmm.
And Alfred Weber went onto her program with another physicist, a geoscientist, I should say, called Lorraine Murray. And she basically went through a whole long list of evidence, which was exactly what Dr. Wood has listed on her website. And at the end of it, she said, "That's how I know that HAARP destroyed the World Trade Center." And we're thinking, well, this is very strange, because she's not talking about the Hutchinson effect. And Alfred Weber didn't mention the Hutchinson effect either at all. And he didn't mention the hurricane, even though we knew he knew about the Hutchinson effect and the 9/11 connection, because he'd interviewed both Judy Wood and John Hutchinson at his house. And he didn't mention it in this interview at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we thought this was very, very strange. And then after that, Sophia Shafquat, she did something very unusual. Are we going to... I just thought I heard the music there again for a minute. What happened about a couple of months after that she actually produced her own theory about how the towers were destroyed, and she said that it was fluoride that destroyed the World Trade Center.
Okay, hold that thought. I hear the music now. I got my hearing aid. I lost my last hearing aid. I had one, and I lay one away in the second one, and we'll be back in a minute for the rest of the... That's just astounding facts. Back in a minute. Stay tuned. Or do we just need a... Joe, just give us a... Are you there, Joe?
I'm here.
You got a quick question for Andrew Johnson? He's still got a lot to cover here before our time runs out.
Yeah, comment. Thank you for everything you're doing from all the way across overseas there. And a comment for the American people that just won't wake up to this. But my question is, what could one of those directed energy weapons do if they actually were directed at people and not buildings? And I'll take my answer off the...
Thank you, Joe.
Well, I think, you know, again, you can look at some of the evidence from the witness accounts particularly. I did refer to, things like people being levitated, David Hanscher, which we have a video of. But a lot of the other information that we've drawn on has come from a set of 500 witness accounts, which were published in 2005 following a Freedom of Information request on the New York Times website. And again, you know, you can download all of those. And I did, in fact, download all 500 of them some time ago. And if you trawl through all those accounts, you'll read, for example, of people that are in World Trade Center Building 6, which had a big hole in the middle. There were, I think, two or three guys walking together through the building, and then all of a sudden one guy says that the other guy just disappeared. So, I think basically it can make them disappear is an answer to that. It can make them, you know, turn to dust, or not obviously to dust, but to particles, in the same way that it made the building turn to particles. I don't think... when the weapon is cranked up to the level that it was, which it obviously had to be cranked up to a high level, or whatever reaction it was that it started off was going on at a very rapid rate, certainly for the two towers, we think that World Trade Center 7 may have been done slightly differently, but it was still the use of the weapon. So basically it just makes people disappear in the same way that the steel disappeared or turned to dust.
Okay, I got another caller here. Let me address, I've got a couple of callers anyway. We don't want to cut all this. Tom in Alaska, go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, hi, Ralph. I just wanted to know if you've tried to get on George Norrie. He's got a huge audience, and get this word out.
Yes. The answer to that question is yes, we have. I have had a conversation involved with that, yes, and a friend of mine actually spoke personally to George Norrie in April 2008 at the conference in Washington, X conference. So yes is the answer to that, but no luck yet.
How about Alex Jones? He's got a pretty good audience too.
Alex Jones doesn't like this sort of evidence. He finds it very the antithesis of what he wants to be talking about, as it would seem. I've actually got an article about Alex Jones on my website if you want to go and check it out. And he tried to say that people who talk about lack of planes at the World Trade Center were liars, and they just make stuff up, and they tried to attack him viciously and things like this. I've actually got an audio clip of him saying this as well. A lot of what I've told you today is actually come. You know, people say, have said to me, oh, you're attacking everyone, Andrew. And in fact, I'm not attacking anyone. What I'm doing is pointing out what they themselves have actually said. And as regards Alex Jones, for example, he says that no planers are liars and they cheat and they make stuff up. I can't, those aren't his exact words, but I've got a little article where I've transcribed, a paragraph where he says essentially that, and you can go and hear the audio clip with this on another radio program. So he doesn't seem to be open to what I'm telling you from my experience. He hasn't contacted me anyway, and if he asked me to go on his program, then I would go on and explain what I've explained to the audience here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks, Tom. We've got a couple more callers. And Michael in New York, you got a question too on point here?
Actually, hello, Ralph. Thank you, Sir Ralph, for your show. It's always very informative, and I appreciate that. I have some comments, and I'm not trying to debunk your guest or anything. I'm just talking about my personal experiences from what I know on 9/11, plus also the Dave on Kleist 9/11 in plain sight. Video.
Yeah, I've seen the Dave. So you have just a, can you give us a comment? Because we're running out of time here.
I'll try to sum it up quick. First of all, I had a cousin in the buildings that day, escaped with his life. And when I talked to him about apparently pods on the belly of a plane firing missiles in, he was so adamant and got very upset with me because he said, Mike, I seen the planes. I seen it coming right in, Mike. But then through further talking over and over, because he was getting very perturbed with me, very annoyed, but I kept going over and over and over until he said, it sounded like a missile. And I said, what'd you say? Because I was trying to tell him that there was missiles fired from some kind of pods off a plane. Now, secondly, Stewart Airport's not far from me. And through mutual friends, I heard a number of months back someone telling me that a good friend of theirs, ex-Air Force, works at Stewart Airport, and he was saying that he was working on drones that morning at Stewart, and they were 757s, and he was... Sure. Confused about that because he never seen him there before, but that's what he does. His specialty was working on drones.
Let me interrupt here. That's good information here, but the evidence that they've got so far that they're putting out, I mean, there's no doubt about that's not what really happened there. So let me get the next caller because we're running out of time here. I don't want to be Kevin in Australia. You got a comment or a question on point?
Hello?
Kevin?
Oh, yeah, right. I'm on. Hey, listen, I'm following this quite closely here. I'm an engineer myself. I'm going to stick to the Hutchison, Judy Wood, and Stephen Jones sort of theme. I haven't quite made up my mind absolutely, what actually went wrong or what happened as far as the 9/11 goes. But, I was travelling around the USA in 2006, going on towards 2007. I was travelling with a lady, a professor, PhD, worked at one of the universities, which I won't, structural engineer, which I'm not going to mention. I don't want to even bring anybody else into it. But we were having a debate about this whole thing. And I'd read a lot of stuff that Professor Judy Woods had compiled.
So you have a question here. I don't want to hurry up, but I got a couple of questions myself, and we only got about 10 minutes.
Yeah, okay. Well, with the actual building, I agree it didn't fall down. It sort of blew up. It didn't vaporize. It was pulverized. After the dust had settled, there were columns and beams and things which were cut off at 45 degree angles, which clearly, points out thermite as far as those beams were concerned, and there were lots of them.
Okay, so is your question because some of the beams looked like they'd been cut off with a welding torch or something? Is that your question to Andrew Johnson?
That wasn't a welding torch. It was like a controlled demolition style cut off.
Okay, why don't we let him answer that question here, and then we'll get back. I appreciate you listening in. Why don't you answer that question for some of those beams?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, the angle cut core columns are commonly brought up. Now, if you actually look at what's on Dr. Wood's website, for the first thing is we're talking about probably the top 90 stories, which were turned to dust. Now, the photographs which show the angle cut columns, we don't actually know who took those photographs. There is a possibility that they're not quite showing what they seem to be showing, but nevertheless, we can't be sure whether thermite was used in the cleanup operation or not. It may have been used. There is no definite witness testimony that's been, given under oath that somebody used a thermite charge to help in the demolition of the remains that were near ground level. But if you go and look at the array of pictures on Dr. Wood's website, you cannot argue that most of the building was destroyed. Now, there may have been a few angle cut core columns in there, as a result of either some thermite charges being laid, but we don't have any other evidence that this is actually what happened. And even if it was used, which I very much doubt, it simply does not explain the other evidence, which is far, far more important to explain. How did cars get upside down? And that sort of thing. And if I may just briefly go back to the plane issue, if you go and read the witness accounts, which I referred to before, and I've written an article about this, a very confusing picture comes out of the stories with the planes. And the other thing to mention is the magnetometer data, which shows a precise dip in the Earth's magnetic field at precisely 8:46, which was supposedly when the first plane hit. And that, to me, is a slam dunk of an energy effect being used not only to destroy the building, but to make the hole in the buildings too. And you can see that in six different instruments, which are actually up your way, Ralph, in Alaska.
So really restated, there could be a contamination or a cover of something put into this just to muddle this up or whatever you want to call it, so that you can't really get a clear, concise picture.
No, I mean, if you have a geoscientist coming on the radio and saying, I'm absolutely 100% certain that Harp did it, who are people going to look at? Are they going to look at this supposedly expert geoscientist, or are they going to look at Dr. Judy Wood and her degrees in civil engineering and engineering subjects? I mean, how are people going to choose between those two? It becomes very, very difficult, which is why, this information is put out there in this form.
Well, you have to look at the evidence. And I got another question that I've not heard an answer to yet. Hurricane. They wanted to cover it up. Why it was there? What's your take on that?
Well, the hurricane is very, very interesting. Again, independently, just to, I'd looked at the evidence for weather modification, and I've got another presentation about that, which I finished sometime in 2006. And I'd seen the evidence that, for example, a hurricane Ophelia had some modification effects. I've got a graphic of that from a satellite, which showed some strange cloud patterns. But the hurricane, again, it went past Bermuda. It was reported on CNN. It was a tropical storm. It did a bit of damage on Bermuda. I think it was on the 7th. And CNN said, "Oh, it's going out to sea." Somebody sent me a BBC story on it as well recently, which I'd not seen before, and they said it was going out to sea, and they said, it's nothing to worry about. In fact, it was going out to sea, but in the direction of New York. So if this hurricane, how did they know it was going to go out to sea? Why were they saying it wasn't a risk? And in fact, after the 7th, it actually went towards land. It went inland. That's not going out to sea. It's going out to sea away from Bermuda, but it was going in the direction of New York. So why weren't the weathermen saying, oh, this could make landfall? I mean, we heard about Katrina and a lot of the other hurricanes are reported maybe a couple of days before they're due to make landfall. And the way that Hurricane Erin was traveling, it was heading towards land, but it was not reported. It was on the, they had an opportunity to report on the morning news on 9/11, and as the weather maps that Dr. Wood has uncovered don't show it. They show rough seas. So if there's two with the hurricane, there are two possibilities. Either it was a coincidence, or it wasn't a coincidence. If it was a coincidence, then why wasn't it reported in the news? Because it was going to be a risk. You know, New York, one of the sort of richest real estate areas in the whole world. You know, with the, if that had been flooded out, Manhattan had been flooded out with storm swells, you know, huge damage, huge cost to the American economy. So, you know, you're going to want to protect that pretty, you know, emphatically. So you're going to be wanting to get that reported as a risk early on. And when this thing's heading towards New York, I mean, how come this wasn't reported, you know?
And is there any chance this hurricane could have had something to do with the energy that was required for whatever happened?
I think it was, because, again, if you go back to John Hutchinson's experiments, one of the things that he's used in a number of his experiments to produce what's called the interference effects of these different energy sources is a Tesla coil. Now, a Tesla coil is a type of special winding of a coil, and, you know, you can go to Google Images and just do Google Tesla coil so you can see what one looks like, or you can go onto Dr. Wood's website and look at the Erin series. And you can see that it does in fact look like a hurricane. If you look at an elevation view, a side view, looks like a Tesla coil. And indeed, we know that storm systems are associated with a large quantity of electrical charge. You know, we get lightning associated with them. And people who have arthritis, for example, or other types of conditions can sense a storm approaching. So we know that the electrical field from the storm is felt remotely. And Dr. Wood has also put on her website weather data from three of the New York airports, LaGuardia, Newark, and JFK, and all three airports had dry thunder on 9/11. And dry thunder is where you get thunder, but no lightning and no rain. So we know that there was a field effect being felt in the vicinity of New York from the hurricane. And you know, our guess is that this was used as one of the field components to somehow facilitate the destruction of the towers. It's also possible, you know, I've suggested that maybe the hurricane was steered there to soak up some of the energy. It was like an energy sponge of some kind, so that the energy could be, you know, carefully controlled to destroy the buildings. I mean, if we look at the way the buildings were destroyed, it was a pretty good job. You know, they just made a bit of a mess up with the Bankers Trust, but all the World Trade Center buildings were taken out, all of them. So there was actually about six or seven buildings destroyed, you know, on 9/11, not just 1, 2, and 7. World Trade Center 6 was pretty much completely destroyed. World Trade Center 4 was cut in half, you know. Weird stuff going on to these buildings. So they obviously had a pretty good grasp of how this was going to unfold. Maybe they even simulated it, you know.
So it'd be a good thing to say that the bottom line is we could contaminate this thing with a little thermite to do something or other or whatever. We could do a little of this and a little of that. But when you look at the real evidence, rubble is gone. Steel towers are being turned into dust. We got cars flipping upside down. We got cars burning that aren't even in close proximity to the building. And we got a hurricane that nobody wants to talk about.
Correct. Absolutely. Those, I think you've very accurately covered the very most important and key pieces of evidence, which if you go to an Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth conference or meeting or talk, you probably won't hear any of that actually discussed. You know, and if you ask a question, they'll just say, well, you know, we don't think that's important because we think thermite explains it. I mean, that's been my experience. You know, they just say that thermite covers everything and they don't really engage with it, which, of course, is exactly what the 9/11 Commission did. You know, they said, well, we know it was Al-Qaeda that did it and we know Bin Laden's admitted it. So we don't need another story because it explains everything. It's the same.
How do they get the superior knowledge?
Yeah, that's it. You know, it's the same tactic. You know, they just ignore the evidence which they cannot explain. And this happens, you know, time and time again, you know, and this has been a theme which I've tried to address. Same with crop circles. You know, we briefly mentioned off air about the issue with the crop circles. And I did a talk on that. You know, people might think I'm making a jump, but I'm actually going to read you a bit of an account. I think we've probably just about got time. And this was actually, I came across this earlier this year. And what interested me was the levitation issue which came in, and it was by somebody called Pat Delgado, and he was in a crop circle in 1989.
Hold that second, just a thought. We'll be right back, and I want to hear this. Boy, this, I'm telling you, folks, amazing information. Amazing what facts are. Anyway, we'll be back in a minute. He's going to talk about the crop circles before we go. Back in a minute. We're back in Andrew, UK, talking about crop circles. Want to get the most in? Go ahead.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so what I came across earlier this year was a report from Colin Andrews, who's a very well-known crop circle researcher. He lives in LA now, I think, but he's originally from the UK. And he was talking about this story from 1989, which involved another chap called Pat Delgado, who recently passed away, but he was, you know, was about 90 years old. And they were in this crop circle at about midnight in June 1989. And this is Pat Delgado's account, and I'll read it out. It's not very long. And he says, standing at the southern position with Colin, I was controlled to reach out and sweep energy from the sound into Colin's body. He heard this sound. I do not know why. Colin then left me and returned to the group at the top of the circle. I turned towards the sound, and my arms were being pulled over the crop with an even greater force, and my body felt it was being pulled upward and forward out of the circle at some perilous angle. With all my strength I could muster, I managed to withdraw my arms, gradually sink down and turn around, so I was now facing north. Eventually, I laid down on my stomach and began to inch my way up to the center of the sloping circle floor, grabbing at bunches of flattened barley stems and pushing with my knees and feet. My progress was slow because whatever the short distance I made forward, a force kept pulling me back half that distance. I was becoming totally exhausted, and at that moment, I wondered what I was fighting against. And then he goes on about trying to get out, and Colin helped him out. But then he says, for some minutes, we sat there, they got out of the crop circle, we sat there answering questions about what had happened, when suddenly some force levitated me to a height just brushing the flattened crop and floated me to the east side of the circle. Now I was feeling really scared. What force could have moved me a distance of about 3 meters while still in the same sitting position? So in other words, he's talking about this account of being levitated. And I was twitched onto this because if you look at what crop circles are, they're flattened areas of crops. And how do you flatten things? Well, you flatten things by putting a weight on them. In other words, by putting a force of gravity onto them. So if you look at what happened at the World Trade Center, there appear to have been effects on the local gravity field because we had people being levitated. We've got several accounts of that. We've got one guy diving under an ambulance. This is in the witness accounts that I mentioned. And then the tower comes down. He puts his hands over his head thinking he's going to die. And the dust cloud comes past and he gets up and he looks up. And the ambulance that he's dived under has gone. So we've got that levitation effect. So we've got gravity effects. And here in crop circles, I think we've got some type of technology which is very similar, but maybe in a different mode of operation to what they used to destroy the World Trade Center. In other words, they can switch gravity on to make the crop circle pattern, and then we're getting a residual effects as well because witnesses go into these circles and report feeling ill, and we get cameras failing and this sort of thing, which to me is some type of residual energy effect from the energy which is used to create these formations. And it's basically a punch-in gravity field. You can have some technology where you draw a design, and then you can create a stronger force of gravity in that area. Because there is no way that all of these crop circles are being created by people with, planks of wood and string. Some of them are done like that, for sure, but certainly not all of them. So that's why I think there is a link, a technological link, and I think that in some cases, these crop circles are being created by the same groups that did 9/11, not in all cases, but in some cases, to deliberately introduce false information into the crop circle movement, particularly, in my view, with regard to 2012. I think there is very much an effort to sort of say, oh, everything's going to come to a head in 2012, and there's going to be this huge great calamity and everyone's going to, die or whatever, version of that you care to talk about. And I think that they're trying to do another large-scale psychological operation, of end times, and trying to force us into that shoe. And I just don't think it's like that at all. I think it's much more complicated than that.
Well, we need to expand our minds, look at the evidence, and they throw all this stuff in to muddle it up and all these cover stories, and the main truth never gets covered. And there is checktheevidence.com is your webpage.
That's
and,
right.
And, Andrew, I really want to thank you. Maybe I can get you back on again. Absolutely astounding information and knowledge, and we need to get this out, folks. Look at the evidence. Look at Dr. Judy Wood. Look at Andrew Johnson. Let's spread this information around, and as always say, watch out for the federales are everywhere.